kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me in my life.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We begin with health and healing, including seven herbs to greatly enhance happiness. Then, dietary fiber can slow the growth of cancer cells. Research suggests that the gut microbes impact adults and children and people with autism. Fresh avocado enhances absorption of essential nutrients for healthy living. Ohio State University did that research. I'll share that with you. We're also going to take a look at vitamin D increasing the survival odds if you have colorectal cancer. That can keep people alive. And new research from the University of Pennsylvania shows there's no evidence whatsoever that alcohol benefits the heart. Hold on a second. We've been living for 30 years with this notion that if you have alcohol, it helps your heart. Yes, and it was wrong. We'll share that. Also, from our environmental and humanistic perspective, 2 million animals are slaughtered each year in the United States by the Federal Wildlife Program. Why? Why does the Wildlife Services, the highly secretive arm of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, end up being able to kill 2 million native animals just in the last 12 months? No publicity about it, no news stories on it. I'll give you the statistics of what they're killing and why, and it's absurd. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Leslie Alexander. We're going to talk about dental hygiene and natural treatments for virtually all the things that go on in your mouth. The brink of mass extinction, a major piece here of from Truthout about what we're likely to be facing, and they give some examples of what's going to be happening around the world to different communities. He selects one here from India. And if the temperature just continues to be as hot as it is, we just had the hottest June in recorded history. And if we continue that, there's going to be an awful lot of problems around the world. So I'll give you that. Also today we're going to be doing some commentaries, including The Curse of American Exceptionalism by John Acheson from Common Dreams. And also the crash in Ukraine. Why is it that the American media immediately, without the evidence being in, assumed that it was Russia or under Russian control? We don't have all the facts, but the facts we have, I'll share with you. Also, the perils of looking into the womb with ultrasound and the failure of America's foster care system. So we have a lot on a lot of topics to get into. We'll be getting into them in depth. Let's begin. Most people want to be happy, and or if they are happy, to sustain it. Well, Natural Society's Christina Sarich came up with some scientific studies, including from Harvard and other places, that if you use certain techniques, you can be happier. And she's talking about herbs. It can lessen insomnia, it can reduce nervousness, they can essentially calm the nervous system. And that helps to increase the chance of feeling happiness. What are these seven herbs? Well, we start with one that I'm sure many people in this audience have used, lemon balm. And this is a really good herb. It's high in volatile oils, especially citronella. It has a mild sedative effect. It can reduce nervousness. It can reduce nervous headaches, depression, and insomnia. It also is good at helping with insect bites. It has antiviral properties, and it stimulates the immune system. So lemon balm, B-A-L-M. Then probably the most commonly used herb in the world, gotu, G-O-T-U, cola, K-O-L-A. It's antiseptic, antispasmodic, peripheral vasodilator, and nerving and relaxant. That means if you have depression or depressive episodes or anxiety episodes, it can calm you down. It strengthens cognitive function and helps with mental stress. Then we have Brahmi, B-R-H-M-I. It's an Ayurvedic herb. It's been used for a long time as a brain tonic and especially good for people to increase memory and to relieve stress. One of the most studied herbs in the world is St. John's wort, Hypericum, and it's been used to treat mild to moderate depression. It's especially helpful for people who don't respond or don't want to take the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs. It's have been studied to show that it's as effective as these drugs without any of the side effects. And in fact, a review of 29 international studies showed that St. John's wort was actually better than a placebo and as effective as the standard prescription antidepressant medication. So St. John's wort's right up there. And then you have oat straw. Oat straw's good. It's a very inexpensive herb, easy to get, good for migraines, shingles, fatigue, even epilepsy, but it's really best for anxiety. So if for any reason you're going through an anxious period, it helps. Also, if you're a person that is working with someone that's detoxing from drug or alcohol or cigarettes, it's especially good for helping curb nicotine cravings. Then we have Siberian ginseng, Eleutherococcus syndicosis. It's a great replacement for caffeine. It offers energy, but no letdown. It doesn't fluctuate your blood cycle up and down. It's an adaptogenic herb, so it adapts to give your body what it needs the most. It can help you with concentration, and it can help you manage stress. And finally, golden root, rhodiola, rosea. It's called Arctic root or rose root. Golden root is considered the queen of adaptogenic herbs. It is terrific for people who have challenge to their immune system, who are under any form of neurological stress, and it's been used in Russia for a long time, and it's very common for people in Siberia. In fact, some of the oldest lived people in the world live in Siberia. I have a lot of people living well over 100 years, and they drink golden root every day. It works by enhancing the body's ability to make serotonin, dopamine, and other neurotransmitters that aids in happiness and stress reduction. Then we have the problem of colon cancer in the United States. I spoke with one of the leading physicians working in East Africa for a long time, Dr. Dennis Burkett. He is known for Burkitt's lymphoma and for discovering it. He told me that it was so rare to see appendicitis, colorectal cancer, or heart attacks that, and he was head of over, or traveled through 67 hospitals in Eastern Africa. He said that you'd get news of one and he'd want to go and study because it was so unusual. And they just don't have the itises there, ileitis, colitis, spastic colon, diverticulitis, because they have a high roughage diet. And they don't eat the processed foods. They eat whole foods. This is from done at the University of Frederick Alexander University, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Medicine. It shows dietary fiber slows the growth of cancer cells. Quote, dietary fiber not only fills human beings up and supports the digestive process, but it also is an effective weapon to treat malignant brain tumors. The research, published in the results in the professional journal Cancer Medicine, have shown that the fibers are not only substitutes for carbohydrates in this diet, but also useful therapeutic effects. Thanks to the fiber, the tumor cells grow more slowly and are less malignant. And the researchers found out especially a subgroup of dietary fibers has an effective act on malignant brain tumors. So, take your fiber each night. Always best to take about a teaspoon, about a half hour or so before you go to bed. Now, if you want to help prevent a stroke or heart attack during your sleep, which a lot of people have them, I suggest you take vitamin E, 400 units, natural, mixed tocopherol. Vitamin C, about 1,000 milligrams buffered. 500 to 1,000 milligrams of quercetin. 100 milligrams of coenzyme Q10. And put a little green powder in with your fiber. That's going to naturally thin the blood, which helps prevent strokes, oxygenate the tissue, protects the tissue, so that way you wake up in the morning. This is research that shows that children with autism tend to have a less diverse population of gut microbes than other children. Scientists suspect modern practice, including eating processed foods and the overuse of antibiotics, are feeding the problem. Now, I've seen this in hundreds of persons who have autism. You look at the diet, and if it's the normal American diet, the symptoms of autism become extreme. However, there are thousands of parents now who have shifted over to what is called the DAN medical protocols or gone beyond those. I believe they're a good starting point, but they're certainly not as good as some of the holistic protocols. And the very first thing you do with a child with autism is you reestablish healthy gut bacteria, exactly what they're saying here. That means you get rid of sugars, you get rid of any caffeinated beverages, you get rid of dairy and gluten. Those are the worst culprits. You get those out completely. Then you reestablish a healthy bacteria with a couple billion of the probiotics, non-dairy probiotics, once or twice a day. On top of that, then you start rebuilding the gut and also helping to chelate out the aluminum and some of the heavy metals and toxins you find in vaccines. That's when we've seen the greatest increase in improvements in people with autism. So it works for people with autism. This research was done and published, and it took a look, and it's finding, hey, quote, the probiotics improves anxiety-like behavior, it improves repetitive behavior, and improves communication in the model, end quote. UCLA scientists say feeding the microbe, in this case in laboratories, especially bred to exhibit autistic disorders, improves their digestive health and virtually eliminated their anxiety. A finding, quote, that has far-reaching implications for humans. And finally, new research, fresh avocado enhances absorption of essential nutrients for healthy living. This is from Ohio State University. And what they said, this was published in the Journal of Nutrition, quote, consuming a whole fresh avocado with either an orange or tomato sauce or carrots significantly enhance vitamin A absorption and conversion of these carotenoids into their active form of vitamin A. And we know, for example, that vitamin A is good for reproductive health, the growth of our bodies, the health of our skin, our immune system, our vision. They're rich in antioxidants. Vitamin A is just all around good in all levels. So if you want to get a better absorption of your vitamin A from your diet, have some avocado at the same time you're having your salad or your meal. You can even take some brown rice and dice up some avocado. It's good there also. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment, we have a lot more to share with you, and we're going to go into great detail on some of these other issues. Please stay with us. Don't you ever be sad. Let's go to a short commentary from John Acheson from Common Dreams. He calls it the curse of American exceptionalism. And I'm sharing this with you because of so many people currently in the media are suggesting that we are so exceptional in providing democracy and truth and protection for the people around the world that we're just too unique. Well, conservatives, and too often what passes for liberals here in the United States, have been using the notion of American exceptionalism to justify a wide range of criminal and near-criminal activity. We're exceptional, all right, but not in the way we think. Let me share with you some areas on this. See whether or not you agree or disagree. Among the most expensive, least effective health care in the developed world. Yeah, the U.S. health care system is designed to create wealth, not health. You've heard me mention many times on the program, including on a special that I did recently on Obamacare. Who wrote it? The insurance industry. Every word of it, the insurance industry. Why did they do it? To guarantee themselves a system that everyone had to participate in and hence would bring them in more than $1 trillion over the lifetime of that in additional profits. They can't lose. They can only win. The whole system at every level, they gamed. So it's not about providing health. It's about providing wealth. We had the most expensive healthcare system in the developed world, not the most effective. When measured on 5 key criteria, the U.S. measures last, or next to last, when compared to 7 other developed countries. For example, you're going to live a longer, healthier life in Australia, Canada, Germany, the Netherlands, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. These countries have single-payer systems with substantial government involvement. So when the U.S. tries to change its system, what does it do? Why, it bolsters the role of the rapacious insurance industry, of course. Yeah, that's exceptional. We have the highest income disparity. The U.S. has the largest gap between rich and poor of any developed nation. In fact, globally, we rank just under Uganda. Yeah, that's right, Uganda. Since 1979, the top 1% increased its income by 275%, while the bottom 90% has gone up slowly, if at all. The middle class is shrinking, and the number of households in poverty is increasing. And if one looks at wealth, not income, it's even worse. Nearly 75% of all growth in wealth since 1979 has gone to the top 5 households, 5%. We're the least mobile between generations. That's right. But the U.S. is the land of Horatio Alger, right? And the American dream. Not so much. Horatio Alger is dead, and the U.S. economy is one of the most rigid in the developed world. In 5 recent studies, U.S. ranks last or second to last in income mobility. A study of European nations found that only Great Britain has less intergenerational economic mobility than the U.S., and some analysts put us behind Britain. Increasingly, if you're born poor in the U.S., you die poor. Once again, we're exceptional, but not in a good way. We work the most hours. Now, boy, that's exceptional. Yeah. No other nation, developed nation in the world, do you work as hard or as many hours as the United States. And exceptional? Yeah, not in a good way. We have the least vacation days. Within the organization of developed nations, every nation but 3 requires companies to provide at least 20 days of leave a year. The 3 are Canada, which requires 18 days off, Japan, which requires 10, and of course, the United States, which requires 0. That's zilch, nothing. And that's us. So yeah, that's exceptional. So you work yourself to death. Happiness in the United States is not even ranked in the top 10. According to the World Happiness Report, the most definitive look at happiness out there, the U.S., despite our great wealth, isn't even the top 10. That's how exceptional we are. Biggest discrepancy between CEO pay and their workers. CEOs in the United States get about 475 times what the average worker makes. truly exceptional. The biggest defense budget, the U.S. spends 600% more on defense than China, which is second behind us, and nearly as much as the rest of the world combined. We have troops stationed over 150 nations around the world, and we have become an imperial power. We fight wars of occupation. Astoundingly, we recently negotiated with Afghanistan to keep troops there. Why? No one seems to be able to tell us, but it seems to have something to do with U.S. exceptionalism. So there you have it. We have an economic system with all the characteristics of a banana republic. We work harder and longer than citizens in any other developed nation, and we're not as happy. We have more expensive, less effective health care. We send our young men and women overseas in a bewildering and expensive quest for what? Security? No. Imperialism and corporate welfare for defense contractors is more like it, and we are less happy than our socialist brethren. And as the result of this kind of exceptionalism, well, how does that impact who we are individually? Then I want to share some insights about animals being killed. Now, this is a non-story in the American media, but it all comes down to looking at why the Wildlife Service feels it has to kill these animals, 2 million of them in the last year. And I can find no reason for them, except that those bureaucracies that continue to grow and are unaccountable will just continue to do what they've done without thinking. Here's what they've killed last year. 320 gray wolves, 75,326 coyotes, 419 black bears, 866 bobcats, 528 river otters, 3,706 foxes, 12,186 black-tailed prairie dogs, and 3 golden eagles. And we pay them to do this? They're notorious for being secret, and they're accountable to no one. How do they kill them? Well, sometimes you use aerial killing. They just fly in a plane and kill them. Do they need to? No, they don't. And yet they do, and they'll continue doing it like all bureaucracies. They become a metastasizing cancer. Now, we have a lot of people, the moment they get pregnant, they rush off as soon as they can to see through the ultrasound what the sex of the child is, etc. The Dr. Kelly Brogan from GreenMed Info has this to say about the perils of peeking into the womb. Quote, clinical use of diagnostic ultrasound imaging during pregnancy has a long history of safety and diagnostic utility, as supported by numerous human case reports and epidemiological studies. However, there exists in vivo studies linking large but clinically relevant doses of ultrasound applied to mouse fetuses in utero to altered learning, altered memory, and neuroanatomy of those mice, end quote. So how many doctors and unknowing patients may be colluding to harm unborn babies? This recent study suggests that the seemingly benign practice of obstetrical ultrasound is one practice that deserves urgent reassessment. Researchers exposed pregnant mice to 14.5 days gestation, a neurologically vulnerable window, to 30 minutes of fetal ultrasound and assessed the pup's behavior at 3 weeks of age. They found that the exposed pups were significantly less interested in social interactions and had significant levels of behavioral hyperactivity in the presence of an unfamiliar mouse. But why did ultrasound become routine? Well, today's children have been exposed to an unprecedented level of ultrasound technology, both in frequency and intensity. In 2001, 67% of pregnant women had at least one ultrasound. 2009, it's 99.8%, with an average of 3 ultrasounds per woman. What accounts for this increase? Do we have evidence to suggest that this intervention is saving lives, changing outcomes, that it's safe? What about the safety in the settings it is applied most frequently at, such as an advanced maternal age, metabolic syndrome, complications? Could these higher-risk pregnancies represent a category of fetus that is more vulnerable to potential side effects of an intervention like ultrasound. It appears that answers to these questions remain elusive despite widespread application because of people want to screen to see what's there. Quote, this is from one survey. Women appear to want sonograms for reasons that may not assist their provider with immediate clinical decision-making. This is a potentially important disagreement between cost savings and patient satisfaction that maternity care providers must consider when deciding whether to perform prenatal sonogram for women with low-risk pregnancies. Are they safe? As is the case for most habitual rather than evidence-based medicine, the vast majority of women undergoing this procedure are not adequately consented by the potential ultrasound risks and the state of benefits as acknowledged by objective scientific literature. And there's a lot of concern. There's implications, for example, of results corroborate existing findings that evidence of delayed learning, reduced hippocampal neuronal dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, as well as disrupted neurological migration, a defect implicated in the pathogenesis of autism. Investigative journalist Dr. Jennifer Margolius has documented research, including interviews with Dr. Manuel Casanova, a neurologist, neuroscientist, researcher who discussed the characteristic changes in gestational brain development in autistic children that can be produced by ultrasound exposure, as well as the epidemiological overlap between escalating ultrasound exposure and autism incidence. And there's randomized studies in humans point to potential increase of low birth weight, delayed speech, poor school performance, dyslexia, and non-right-handedness. So there's a lot of reasons why you should not get ultrasound. But unfortunately, people get into fads and they all want it. They're not looking at the harmful effects, and they should. This, I think, is extremely important. This is from Josham Hapagiam of Global Research. Have you ever wondered what happens when the state takes a child? What happens when a parent cannot take care of the child, so it becomes a ward of the state? We don't think about this in our society. We assume that the state has the resources, financial resources, and the technical resources, and the humanitarian resources, social workers and caregivers, to see that the child is well taken care of until they are old enough that they can go out to school on their own and get out and go on with their life. Here's what this person says, quote, I work with the largest county children's welfare services in America for more than a quarter of a century. For several decades, as a licensed therapist in Los Angeles County, I provided mandated therapy to both children as well as young adults who are aging out of the child welfare system. Over the years, I made countless trips to L.A. County Children's Court representing dozens of children and families of my clients. My decades of firsthand mental health experience saw the destructive inside machinations of a corrupt, overloaded, thoroughly broken foster care system do more damage than good to children and families with whom I closely worked. Like all institutions in America, the child welfare system is just another corrosive, morally bankrupt, oppressive mechanism by which to control the poorest people in this country, acting as a national conduit pipeline to prison, substance abuse, human trafficking, homelessness, mental illness, and early death. Though each county child protective service department in the United States operates under a separate budget funded by individual county, state, and federal mental health source dollars, the child welfare system in this country is so overburdened and systematically flawed, it has been failing our kids miserably for a long time now. We all hear about the horror stories of murdered children in the foster care system who fell through the cracks, high-profile cases exposing the tragic fate of young people trapped in a system that fails to protect them are far too common. They are written about extensively in newspapers all the time, but the American public rarely is privy to the inner workings of a system gone bad from the first-hand perspective of an insider who worked within that failed system for decades. This is my account of the child welfare system as a therapist who worked out in the community with young people on either probation or within foster care as well as their residential group homes. I observed the broken system from the inside out. Universal harm rights are routinely violated. Human rights are violated every minute and every hour of every single day, bringing with each passing year even more atrocities of neglect and abuse from the system designed to protect children. Instead, it is literally destroying them. The shocking, gaping problems that the largest child welfare department in America, that is the L.A. County Department of Children and Family Services, that I interface with for so many years, epitomizes what's gone so terribly wrong with the national system operating in every state and county throughout the United States. To illustrate the blatant flaws inherent in the child welfare system, I shall present, I'll only use one story, the stories of two families that as a therapist I strongly advocated for children as my clients to reunify with their biological families in the L.A. County Children's Court. The first case was an 8-year-old boy I shall call Pablo, who when 2 months old was placed in the care to live with a boy's aunt due to his mother being an alleged drug addict, unable to properly care for the child. Pablo was also had a sister, 6 years older, also placed with a biological mother's sister. Prior to my being assigned to Pablo as Pablo's therapist, the 15-year-old sister had grown increasingly rebellious and defiant, clashing with her aunt, and after running away from home, the system decided to place her in the foster care, and because of the volatile relationship sister had with the aunt as her primary caregiver, the social worker assigned to the case became suspicious of the aunt's capacity as primary caregiver to Pablo. The normal contracts with local mental health agencies in the community to provide mental health services to minors with open cases in the child welfare system. I worked as a clinical manager in one of those mental health providers centers overseeing community service operations in both biological and foster care homes as well as the group homes in the Pasadena area. I also directly supervised approximately 8 to 10 therapists, including Pablo's therapist. So when this whole thing grew and concerned about the aunt's capacity to provide a healthy home environment for Pablo, based upon the recommendations, the children's court judge stipulated that a licensed therapist be assigned Pablo's case. At that point, I became directly involved in Pablo's care as both his weekly individual therapist as well as his and his aunt's family therapist. My assessment of Pablo and his aunt's relationship after providing therapy services in their home for about 2 months was that Pablo was responding well to treatment and already beginning to make considerable progress with his treatment plan goals that I had collaboratively formulated with both Pablo and his aunt. They had to do with learning to stay on task with such daily activities as picking up toys after play, following his aunt's prompts for redirection. As a child given the mild case diagnosis of ADHD, a way overdiagnosed mental health classification conveniently used to label high-energy children who simply have minds of their own and pose as management problems in an educational system designed to stamp out children's spirited creativity in favor of a docile compliance. Pablo's experienced some difficulty focusing both in the classroom and at home and engaged in hyperkinetic motor movement and behavior that would often get him in trouble with both settings when he failed to comply with adult-imposed rules. Under the psychiatric care of one of my agency staff psychiatrists, Pablo was taking daily medications prescribed for his ADHD. After I completed and presented my written assessment and clinical findings noting early progress in treating pre-protocol under my service agency contract with County Children's Services against my recommendations and based on approval of a social worker supervisor, unbeknownst to me, one afternoon the social worker abruptly entered the home and forcibly removed Pablo from the only family home he had ever known in all of his 9 years, severely traumatizing and terrorizing the little boy. Neither he nor the aunt nor I ever saw what seemed like an ambushed assault in violation of the worst order coming. In one fell swoop, they were not only interfering and undermining the family's progress and treatment, they were also destroying this family. The social worker created an extreme havoc at the home, Pablo was crying hysterically and uncontrollably as the social worker literally ripped him from his aunt's arms and physically coursed him out the door. In all the turmoil, chaos, and family drama he had created, the highly unprofessional social worker forgot to even take any of Pablo's clothes or medications with him prior to placing the highly distraught boy against his will and choice into foster care, a task that was left to me to follow up the next day. After receiving the broken-hearted aunt's horrifying account, I took Pablo's clothes and meds over to the nearest foster home where Pablo was now living, consoled a still very traumatized Pablo, and spoke briefly with the foster parents who had worked with the center for a number of years. Children's services had completely gone against the family's therapist's recommendations, but most importantly, against the family's best interest to stay together as an intact family. Suddenly and violently uprooting this fragile young child with absolutely no justifiable reason at all. Clearly, Pablo was severely traumatized by the system's cruel and unusual decision to suddenly break up his family. There was no question that the aunt loved her nephew as her own son, and the little nephew was definitely loved and needed his aunt, as every child needs his mother. Seeing the irreparable damage and harm the system of willfully inflicted on my clients, I immediately contacted the social worker and her supervisor and arranged an emergency meeting a couple of days later. When I pressed for an explanation, neither the social worker nor the supervisor could supply a remotely legitimate reason for separating the boy from his own family. The most they could come up with was some feeble mumbling, something about the boy's teacher remarking that one day Pablo had come to school wearing dirty clothes. No consideration apparently was ever made to think that every chance this little guy got, he was on his knees playing in the dirt, because that was really healthy, energetic, lively little boys, and they do it. For unknown reasons, it was clear that the system was on a witch hunt to demonize the aunt in their false accusation to break apart the family. I saw firsthand the criminal misuse of a totalitarian system run amok, operating under the sinister guise of protecting children from harm, but by its own vindictively blind and destructive actions was doing grave harm to my valuable, innocent client, who never knew what hit him. I started seeing my client for his individual therapy sessions at his new foster home, but used to seeing me within the safe and familiar confines of the only home he had ever known, I quickly realized he was not comfortable in the foster care setting, so I began bringing him to a nearby park a couple of times a week to help the child cope with the trauma the system had senselessly caused. Every time I would show up, the first thing out the door, he'd be running and say, "When can I go home to my aunt?" It was heartbreaking. As a professional, I could never express my true feelings about the Nazi-like tactics responsible for his current trauma, anxiety, and pain. In a matter of weeks, the boy had gone from living his entire life with his aunt and sister, then to just living with an aunt, and then every other week, four-hour visits with his sister, to now not living with any family at all, to his never-ending question. I finally told him, "Pablo, I'm doing everything possible to get you home with your aunt." Because the child's system had absolutely no basis for removing Pablo from his family home and knew it, they got caught in the compromising position of having to save face, notoriously unable to ever admit mistakes. In the meantime, they were constantly challenging, confronted by this therapist strongly recommending immediate reunification with the aunt. Just prior to the next scheduled children's court hearing, on the holiday weekend, the social worker and foster mother met with Pablo at the foster home and actually manipulated the 9-year-old into allegedly agreeing that his aunt had used a belt to punish him. Without any visible sign of evidence, other than the little boy's forced confession, at the last minute they were able to bring fabricated evidence to court that would assure the judge to back their decision to keep the child locked in foster care indefinitely. When I spoke with the aunt, I completely believed her when she said she had never touched Pablo with a belt. And in my next session with Pablo, he himself even denied such an event had ever taken place. Clearly, the social worker and foster parent falsely twisted and put words in the boy's mouth to maliciously trick him into keeping him from living with his aunt. After showing up at children's court a number of times in person, writing numerous letters and reports, the court judge expressing my serious concern that the move to foster care was clearly not in the child's best interest and doing irreparable damage to the young boy, the children's court judge suddenly ordered me off the case. and it continues downhill from there. Now, mind you, that is simply one example of a corrupt, bloated, senseless, malignant bureaucracy. So just remember, anytime you hear that a child has been removed from loving parents because they didn't want to vaccinate them or some other, you know, stupid reason, understand the children's gulag that they go into. The entire system is corrupt and should be exposed for what it is. But they have no advocates, they have no voices. That's why I just shared that with you. Nice to have you with us today. 14 reasons the White House is the world's more stable and less violent than ever before. Remember that? It's a lie. Michael Snyder. With a straight face, Barack Obama has been repeatedly telling us that the world is, quote, more stable, less violent than ever. In fact, he believes that this is the best time in history to be alive because of how peaceful and stable everything is. And of course, Obama is more happy to take credit for his role in bringing all this stability about. Just this week, his press secretary told the media that his administration, quote, has substantially improved the tranquility of the global community. Aw, shucks. Really? Can we all do a big kumbaya? Apparently, these guys don't think that we will notice all the violence, the war and terrorism constantly raging around us. It'd be wonderful if the planet actually was becoming a more peaceful place, but instead the exact opposite is happening. The world is becoming increasingly unstable, and if we aren't very careful, we could see World War III break out. The truth of the matter is that all of the challenges we face, all the problems that we have, if you had to choose any moment to be born in human history, not knowing what your position was going to be, who you were going to be, would you choose this time? We're told the world is less violent than it's ever been. It's healthier than it's ever been. Wow, guess no one ever stood outside of Disney World and watched the people walk through. So let's just take a look, all right? The downing of the Malaysian airline flight MH17 has brought Ukraine and Russia even closer to the brink of war. The government in Kiev is blaming Russia, and Russia is blaming the government in Kiev. And Barack Obama doesn't know what to make of it, except that he believes it's Russia. If it wasn't for revolutionary Ukraine groups funded by George Soros and the U.S. government, among others, the Ukrainian government may never have been violently overthrown, and there might not have been a civil war in the Ukraine. Oh, but the American media didn't talk about the black ops, the funding of the neo-Nazis in the Ukraine. None of that conversation do you hear. Relations between the United States and Russia are the worst that they have been since the end of the Cold War. And the economic sanctions that Obama just slapped on Russia are not going to help matters. But let's put it this way. Who benefits if there is another world war or preparing for war? The multinational corporations engaged in wars. The private corporations, the defense contractors, the intelligence agencies, they make hundreds of billions of dollars collectively. So all you have to have is NATO putting all those missile systems around Ukraine, right on Russia's border. And boy, that's not going to make the Russians happy. But then again, we've been posturing with China too, trying to get Australia and Vietnam and Cambodia to allow us to put all forms of military operations in their countries. Well, that's a good way to say thank you to China for loaning us more money than any other country in world history, over $6 trillion, I believe, between $3 and $6 trillion. Yeah, and that, I don't know why anybody would get angry if you wanted to posture a new Cold War. The neocons. Now, of course, there's no problem in Israel right now, is there? That's a safe place, especially if you live in Gaza. And how about let's vacation in Syria? Is there a civil war in Syria? It's been raging for years now. What role did the United States and Saudi Arabia play in bringing down the Syrian government by arming now ISIS and other terrorist groups? But hold on a second. Those were moderate terrorists, maybe even meditating terrorists, maybe even yoga meditating terrorists. Maybe they just can't wait to get a little rubby dub. We funded them, just like we did the Mujahideen. Didn't we do the same thing in Libya? Beautiful beaches in Libya. Not sure you want to be there at this time of year. The weather's a little hot. Oh, I forgot, the country's in complete lockdown, breakdown, total chaos. We created that. And then we have the civil war in Iraq. It's getting worse. ISIS has captured over one-third of Iraq and Syrian territory, and they're using American weapons. The Kurds claim that ISIS is now using chemical weapons against them, and the Kurds are now saying, we want the oil fields and we want autonomy. No problem there. The Iraq government has told the United Nations that ISIS was able to steal 88 pounds of uranium from Mosul University. Well, some people say you can only make a dirty bomb with that. Barack Obama told us that we are, quote, liberating Libya. Okay. What was Libya before we liberated it? How much of a threat did it pose to us or anyone else? It didn't. Now go to Libya. And then look at the Islamic terror group Boko Haram. Continues to cause havoc in Nigeria and spreading out. And then, of course, we have Somalia and civil war there, and the Sudan and civil war there. A fearsome violent conflict erupted on the outskirts of the Joint African Union mission in Somalia. And here in the United States, we have horrific gang violence, warring between drug cartels in Central America, South America, and Mexico. No problem in Mexico, except that 150,000 people have been killed because of it. So, little tiny list, not even 1% of the problems in the world. So, try to explain to me where exactly we have made it safer and it's the best time to be alive. Don't think so. I'm Gary Knoll, and we try to bring you some insights and issues that generally are not confronted in other places. I'm told that our guest is not able to be in a good connection. There are just a cell phone, so we don't want to have that. We'll invite our guest back to do a full interview when we can get a better connection. Let's go over and say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have a number of emails here. One of them comes from Roger from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And he says, I'm a big fan of track and field, and a friend of mine was competing in a race several months ago, and he actually recognized you power walking. He says, you were very focused, you were in great shape, and you did, in fact, win a gold medal. And he says, I download your program every day. I listen to it on the way into work, and I especially like your progressive commentary hour. He says, in my opinion, it's very stimulating and very scholarly. It's like a breath of fresh air to my brain. He said, I heard you were going to do a special on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And he says, you realize that you're going to get slammed. And he said, do you ever consider not doing a topic because it's just too politically disadvantageous to you?
All topics are politically disadvantageous. All I would do is come in every day and talk about the value of sunflower sprouts for an hour. The reality is, the moment you talk about something, write about it, do a documentary on it or a lecture on it, you're alienating a certain segment. The war on health, that alienated the entire pharmaceutical industry and the FDA and the U.S. Public Health Service and the National Cancer Institute. Knocking on the devil's door alienated the entire nuclear industry. Now, these are large and formidable groups. They have 1,000 ways to attack you. We're using Wikipedia, which is in their pocket. And anyone who's ever gotten on there will know that no matter what corrections you make, the people instantaneously correct it back. So the pharmaceutical industry has enormous influence, and they'll eventually be exposed on that, and the people that have been paid to write pieces. You simply have to accept that if you're going to tell the truth on something, just don't personalize the attacks. They're going to come. Look at the larger good that comes when you educate people on an issue that they would not otherwise know about. That's what's important. So tonight I'll be doing at the new Progressive Commentary Hour, time is 7 o'clock, I'm going to have a special report on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. My goal is to see that peace and security is afforded to both the Israelis, who deserve it, and the Palestinians, who deserve it. And Rabbi Michael Lerner, one of our nation's leading Jewish intellectuals and spiritual political activists, will be on. We'll also have Professor Juan Cole, he's an outstanding Middle Eastern professor, University of Michigan, will be on. But we'll be talking about things that are discussed in ways that the mainstream media would never allow a conversation. They don't allow conversations. If anything is even challenging at all, one millimeter away from what it should be, there are enormous lobbying powers that will immediately attack. Hence, Americans only understand one side of an issue. They never hear the full explanation. That's why we went to war in Iraq, because every single pundit on television and the talking heads, all from the foundations and the think tanks, were saying, we've got to get the weapons of mass destruction, but there were none. And there was evidence that the curveball was a fraud, but no one listened to us. So some people will listen, others won't. But ask yourself this, Luann. If I do deep scholarship on health, nutrition, the environment, on looking at gas hydrofracking, nuclear energy, vaccinations, and the drugging of our children, do you think that I would bring any less scholarship and insight and professional standards to anything else I do? So I'm always amazed when someone will say, gee, Gary, I really appreciate what you had to say on health and nutrition, the environment, but don't talk on any other topic because you're wrong. Am I? Show me I am. I don't approach anything with an indifference or a lackadaisical attitude. We do an enormous amount of research. We have our own scholars and residents. But if I'm going to say something that they're not in alignment with, they're going to react, not reason. They will not be interested in the truth as I share it. They'll be interested in defending their truth as they know it. And you just have to accept that. So to answer your question, no, there's no topic I won't take on, irrespective of the political consequences or the blowback. I just don't come from that mindset.
Well, I think the scholarship piece is the most important. I've gotten some calls from people who are very defensive about their ideology, if they're from their pro-Israel, and it's just what you said. They have to protect their illusion of security, because beyond that, they don't want to hear. And yet, these innocent children and these families are being just annihilated. And it's horrific what's happening.
Well, we're going to do a two-hour special on it tonight at 7 to 9 o'clock on Progressive Commentary Hour. Next issue.
Next, I have something here from Karen, and she's from Los Angeles. She says, I've listened to you on KPFK for over 20 years, and I download your program at night when I get back from the gym, or I take it with me while I'm doing an hour of spin on the bike there, and I listen. I share your DVDs, your documentaries, and your articles to everyone I know. The question I have is this. You used to be on Roy of Hollywood show, and it's just not the same. That vitality is missing, and we so miss you on KPFK. She says, after 31 years every week, do you ever regret having left KPFK and Roy of Hollywood show?
No. I chose to leave because I chose not to be affiliated with a station that is anti instead of pro. I don't need to be affiliated with anything that is destructive in its dialogue, that is isolating in its behavior, or that is regressive in its philosophy. And that's my opinion. When I hear people attacking one another by name and denigrating them on a radio station, I don't want to be a part of that station. I don't have to be. I have my own radio station with an audience that's 1,000 times larger and more progressive. So understand that there's a time in life where you've done enough and that chapter has to close, because what good are you serving? The whole purpose of being in the media is to share insights and provocative challenges that empower people. empowering people means that you're pro-growth, you're pro-humanistic values, you're pro-the environment, you're pro-health, you're pro-people living a long life, irrespective of what their political or educational or financial considerations are. I don't care if you're a Jew, an atheist, or a Christian fundamentalist. You all deserve to live a long and healthy life. So you have to be pro to their lives, pro to their right to a long life. And I don't affiliate with things that are anti, all the time anti. The Pacifica Foundation should ask themselves, what would Lewis Hill, the founder, say today if he realized how ghettoized the sounds have become on so many of the stations? It's the same reason I'm not on PFW in Washington anymore after 30 years also. So when you no longer are working in alignment and synergistically and harmonizing with the energy, then it's time to say thank you and reharmonize somewhere else. That's what I believe. Okay?
Makes sense.
Thank you for your call. Let's say hello. Oh, no, we're out of time. I don't have time for calls, so I see some are up there. I'll look forward to taking some calls on tomorrow's program. And I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen today. We look forward to sharing more tomorrow. And in a few minutes, I'll do a two-hour special on our sister station on WBAI in New York. Hope you tune in to that because it'll be an interesting and empowering 2 hours with Michael G. Haskins. For everyone else, have a nice day. See you tomorrow. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead, who's standing by. Hi, Utrice.
Hello. I get a feedback. Hello, Gary, and hello, Luann. Today, we're talking about how Washington moves fast on war and foreign conflicts, but not so much on pressing domestic matters, and why liberal and progressive movements are still colorblind to the centrality of racism in American life.
Okay, I would certainly agree with the liberal, because unfortunately today, the people who are truly progressive no longer need to label themselves. They're looking for the truth. And that's why we have 42% of all Americans now consider themselves independent. For the corporate liberal, corporate Republican, you're absolutely right. We look forward to what you're saying and what insights you're sharing in just 2 minutes.